as an organization, offered no tangible benefits. We wouldn't do anything except sending donation letters. I figured if we could get a little newspaper for the town, where it could advertise all the business for a cheap price, maybe we could start there. So he did. Under his leadership, they started with reinvigorating the town's Memorial Day festivities. "We wanted to work on that, build that up again," he says. Then he started a local pub crawl to go along with that. "We have the pub run in Freeland. Challenge for all the people to run around to different bars. I started working on that. I got a lady that had a printing company, not a printing company, an advertising company. And she came in and she started the Freeland Progress. The Freeland Progress, back in the day, was one of the newspapers that used to be in town. The first and last newspaper in town. I did a lot of research on that. So that is how we brought the newspaper back. Now all the business people, or anybody that's in the chamber, are advertised in there. So that's a benefit. They can advertise cheap for a month. We started with a business-size ad at $25. The response was amazing." He left the chamber presidency after 2 years, having doubled the membership, and is still heavily involved. His big goal now is to try to draw other businesses to the Main Street area. "We always try, but it's hard to attract people here. We're having a hard time keeping people here. They're moving away, going to college, and the kids aren't coming back. My wing nights here on Thursdays used to be nothing but kids. Now it's not that way. I would see the kids and be able to say, 'Oh, okay, that's the future.' It's not like that anymore," he says. "I used to see kids running around at 17 or 18, get them when they turned 21, and keep them when they turned 25 and got married," says Kochi. "That doesn't happen anymore. Now they're going to school before they're 21, and then they move. Bring people to Freeland? It's tough. There's nothing. What are you going to come for? To get a job here is tough. A good-paying job. There's nothing in the area. Freeland. Nobody's coming to Freeland anytime soon. It's all really sad." Kochi marvels at the fascination in the East Coast's metropolitan areas with how it might be possible that places like Freeland shocked the world by voting for Trump. People are still scratching their head about why people voted for Donald Trump. "Well, here is the thing. We voted for ourselves, and that is the thing they missed. That is the thing they still miss. I turn on the television, and they talk about how he brags or this or that about him, and they still don't talk to us. They still don't hear us. They still don't get us. We are a part of America, too, and we are a part of America that wants to be part of something that takes everyone forward, takes us all together," he says. The direction the country was taking, culturally, economically, spiritually, worried Kochi long before Trump came along. "We've always been able to be different, come from different places, and still feel that pride that we were all in this together, that we are American, and that means something special. It means hard work. It means diversity. It means embracing each other's traditions. Well, we got away from that and move towards only some people's traditions and cultures matter, and the other people just need to go away. One of the reasons I think Trump did so well and attracted a lot of Democrats was because he's not very ideological. He's a get-in-there-and-do-things kind of guy. People in this town have told me that they are fed up with politics and politicians and just want someone to get in and do what needs to be done. And help everybody out. Some of the stuff is getting out of hand," he says. Kochi admits he was surprised on election night. "Honestly, I didn't think he was going to win. I did not think so. When he did, I was like, 'Wow, a lot of people are feeling like we do.' That's what I really thought. People are getting fed up with the news and what's going on and just all that nonsense." What I think people who aren't from Mid-America do not still understand, several months later, is that this commitment to being part of this movement is just starting. We wanted to be part of something, part of a community that we feel as though we are giving back to, you know, a very American feeling, I think. And that is the core of this movement. And I think it's going to be a hell of a thing to break the bubble of Washington. But I think the only thing that has a chance of breaking it is this. That's one of the things that people missed about this election, says Cochi. We've talked about this. It was his message. Make America great. It was potent and powerful. It takes you to a better place. It's aspirational. And I think that Hillary's message strung together was flat. It didn't say, come with me, he says. And aspirational is the heart of what makes America move forward all the time. Like you said, he says to Volchek. Cochi leaves the interview to go organize the kitchen. The other side restaurant has cleared out. By now, it's late in the evening, but the bar is still filled with regulars. Two couples are playing pool, and they order another round. I have to get the order ready for the food in the morning. It's lobster night tomorrow night. Have to go catch a few, he jokes, then disappears into the kitchen. But not before several locals pat him on the back and greet him. He's a good guy, says Volchek of Cochi, as he finishes off his second bowl of spaghetti. Really good guy. Really cares about the community, and honestly, I think that is why all of us voted for Trump. I think that is the part no one really got. Chapter 7. King Cyrus Christians. In his pre-political days, Donald Trump made regular appearances on the national radio show of shock jock Howard Stern, routinely going on air to talk about his sexual exploits or the anatomical features of starlets who struck Stern's fancy. His crassness continued onto the campaign trail, with his taunting of fellow Republican contender Carly Fiorina as ugly, telling a Rolling Stone writer, "Look at that face. Would anyone vote for that?" Trump mocked a disabled reporter and fumbled through embarrassing explanations of his own thin religiosity. Yet from the Iowa caucuses forward, Trump exceeded expectations with a strong performance among evangelical and fundamentalist Christians and conservative Catholic voters. In Iowa, where the respected Pew Research Center study on religious life in America found that 77% of adults call themselves Christians, and half of them are self-described conservative Christians, Trump won a respectable second in the nominating caucuses and a historic victory in the general election. In the Deep South's Bible Belt, Trump won every state except Oil Patch Texas and Oklahoma, both of which stuck with Texas Senator Ted Cruz. Trump's best early primary margins were in Alabama, Mississippi, and Louisiana, all heavily evangelical electorates, where he topped 40% in multi-candidate fields. In the general election, more revelations of Trump's lasciviousness emerged, and still, conservative Christian voters stuck with the man who had not long ago been a pro-choice, pro-gay rights supporter of liberal Democrat Nancy Pelosi. Leaders of many evangelical Christian groups were quick to distance themselves during the campaign from Trump's personal values, but reaffirmed their political bargain. They were willing to ride the Trump candidacy with all its bumps because he had explicitly promised to choose a Supreme Court nominee from a defined list of acceptable conservative possibilities. In the wake of the October release of the bawdy backstage tape with Access Hollywood host Billy Bush, Tony Perkins, head of the Family Research Council, said, "My personal support for Donald Trump has never been based upon shared values. It is based upon shared concerns." As the election progressed, and Trump gathered more support from evangelicals than expected, some Christian observers likened his appeal to that of Cyrus the Great, a 6th century B.C. pagan Persian king, who released enslaved Jews from generations of bondage in Babylon, enabling their return to Jerusalem where they would construct the temple that preceded the Herodian Temple Mount that still stands today. Christian motivational speaker Lance Wallnau, credited in some quarters with originating the King Cyrus analogy about Trump, wrote a book on it and said, "America has been unraveling for 2 decades, and Christians are probably the people that are most sensitive to it. The mercy of God intervened and gave us an individual who has the willpower and the tenacity to be able to do a reset." Trump's appeal and ability to retain the support of so many seemingly incompatible conservative religious voters merit a deeper look at this archetype of Trump voters, the King Cyrus Christians. It is possible that Trump would have struggled to get these voters to trek to the polls had he not run against a villain to the cultural right with the long pedigree of Hillary Clinton. It's also possible that 4 decades of culture war has just made these voters Republican and active under any circumstances. Trump, of all potential candidates, would seemingly have been the one to test that boundary. The alliance between the billionaire and the believers, however transactional, has persisted well into Trump's presidency. The Great Revolt survey indicates that 91% of the group approves of Trump's performance in office, and 65% trust him most to do what's right for the country, besting congressional Republicans, congressional Democrats, big business, and the news media on that question. Roughly 2/3 Protestant and 1/3 Catholic, and more conservative than the rest of Trump's coalition, this group of voters helped him roll up massive margins in rural counties across the Midwest and held up his sagging numbers in the suburbs. This group placed a high premium on Trump's promise to replace Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia with a conservative, and 72% of them believe abortion should be made mostly illegal. Trump's first major accomplishment, the confirmation of conservative jurist Neil Gorsuch to the highest court in the land, ensured that the bargain Perkins and his fellow King Cyrus Christians made would at least be partly repaid. Julie Bales, Bristol, Kenosha County, Wisconsin. Julie Bales did not decide she would vote for Donald Trump until the moment she walked into the voting booth on Election Day 2016. "Even then, I still had struggles with voting for him," she says. The 44-year-old mother of 7 took issue with Trump's coarse language and boorish behavior and found them incompatible with the commands of her own Christian faith. Ultimately, 2 things, she says, pushed her into his column once inside that voting booth: the belief that he was someone who would be a warrior for religious freedom, and that he would right the ship on national security and the economy. It was clear that despite his lack of virtues, he was going to be a champion of religious liberties, she says. The attack on Christianity that has happened over the past few years, in both the culture and with court decisions, has been awful, and honestly, people of faith feel that personally, says Bales, who ran a non-profit ministry and thrift shop with her husband for 7 years. "I was looking for a warrior for our values, for righting the direction of the country. When he said he would appoint Supreme Court justices who would uphold the values of our country and our Constitution, I started to bend towards listening to what he stood for," she says. Bales is a dynamic force of nature. The mother of 1 daughter and 6 sons, she has been married to her husband Donnie since high school. Bales is trim and fit. Her raven hair is cut in a modern-day shag, and she is wearing dark blue jeans and a deep purple collared blouse, the same one she wore in a family photo from earlier in the year displayed in her living room. She is beautiful inside and out. One of her children, Seth, was diagnosed with a rare autoimmune disease when he was 7 years old. Seth's in the middle. He's got 3 above him and 3 below him. We have traveled to the Mayo Clinic constantly since 2009. The disease he has is very rare, and he's been on the highest dose of low-dose chemotherapy for 9 years. He swallows 196 pills a week, as well as patches and injections and all kinds of stuff. But he's thriving. He's surviving. From surviving to thriving. So we're grateful for every day, she says. She holds her emotions in check for now. She smiles. There is constant buoyancy in her cadence. This is a woman whose faith fills her spine with strength and optimism. The Baleses live in Bristol, in Wisconsin's Kenosha County, which straddles the exurbs of two major metropolitan centers, Milwaukee and Chicago. Their farm sits on 150 acres along U.S. Highway 45, a mostly rural road that takes you to Chicago's O'Hare International Airport, 46 miles to the south. In 2016, this county, the one-time home of major auto plants owned by AMC and then Chrysler, broke a 44-year Democratic voting streak when it picked Donald Trump over Hillary Clinton by fewer than 300 votes. Not even Ronald Reagan, in his 49-state re-election landslide, could carry Kenosha County for the GOP. Bordered by Lake Michigan on the east, Kenosha County today has 168,183 people. And unlike a lot of counties that flipped its support from Barack Obama in 2012 to Donald Trump in 2016, it is growing, albeit more slowly than the national average. Kenosha still feels Rust Belt industrial in its eastern portion, a result of the lakefront harbor and railroad lines that encouraged the development of factories in the last century. The western portion of the county remains rural, and the growing central section, bisected by Interstate 94, which links it to Minneapolis, Madison, Milwaukee, and Chicago, is driving the county's growth. Within yards of the interstate is a bustling Amazon distribution center employing 2,000 people, and the corporate headquarters of packaging giant Uline, relocated from high-tax Illinois a few years ago, and now employing 2,600 Kenosha Countyans. Smaller plants, such as Kennel Lighting, have joined the exodus from Illinois to Kenosha and post now hiring signs, brandishing opportunities not normally associated with Trump country. That growth fills up subdivisions and thriving non-denominational churches with big video screens and mood lighting in their auditoriums. Trump performed well in these growing precincts, outpacing Romney's 2012 surplus by 11 points in the fast-growing center of the county, and by 15 points in the rural west, in addition to narrowing the margin of defeat for Republicans in the graying blue-collar city to the east. Much has been made of the resonance of Trump's message among people who have seen their local economies crater. But for a key slice of his coalition, it was attacks on their values on the national stage by a culture careening leftward that drew voters to his bombast. Perhaps no state in the blue wall that Trump turned Republican red better exemplifies the dual pull of cultural and economic concerns than Wisconsin. Julie and Donnie Bales, along with two of her adult voting children, could easily have been expected to stay home on election day when faced with the choice between the liberal Clinton and the secular Trump. Instead, they were part of a political tipping point in Wisconsin, a state in which 22% of the adult population is affiliated with an evangelical Protestant church, and 71% overall identify as Christian. Wisconsin is not a transient state. It ranks fifth in the nation in its share of those born there who stay there, trailing only Sun Belt boom states Florida, Georgia, North Carolina, and California, owing in part to deep family connections and a traditional lifestyle. Most of its people are the sons and daughters of the sons and daughters who settled here 100 years ago, and most of them have lived here all of their lives, or left and returned to raise their families. many can trace their family tree back generations on the same plot of land that they, or some member of their family, still inhabit. Once a bastion of American socialism, and today home to the progressive idol of Madison, Wisconsin had been stubbornly Democratic for the better part of two generations. With a proud labor history, many of the Badger State's cultural conservatives could not get comfortable with Republican coziness with big business in elections prior. It was one of only 10 states won by Democrat Michael Dukakis in the 1988 presidential election, and hadn't been won by any Republican since 1984. Trump's economic message rallied voters with manufacturing in their blood, but he also scored big among traditional values voters seeking a restoration of cultural respect. It is a state filled with national pride and nostalgia. Voters were looking for someone who spoke to their traditional cultures, someone who would protect those cultures. Still, evangelical voters and traditional and observant Catholics were perhaps some of the least likely to stay with Trump as his unconventionally harsh rhetoric and allegations of a sordid personal life poured out during the campaign. They didn't have to vote for Clinton. They could have just stayed home. But some, like Bales, ultimately stuck with the thrice-married Trump, albeit reluctantly, because he was going to be a warrior for people of faith. He wasn't going to let us down. And that would begin with his Supreme Court choices, says Bales, who attends Crossway Community Church, a modern non-denominational megachurch with acoustic guitar and trap-set drum music and an evangelical approach to the gospel. Trump's lack of familiarity with even the basic tenets of Christian observance were on display during the primary campaign, even as he attempted to appeal to religious conservatives. In a forum sponsored by the Family Research Council, a socially conservative lobbying organization, in his second month as a candidate, Trump said he had never asked God for forgiveness, an assessment he re-upped 6 months later, putting him completely at odds with the central dicta of evangelical theology. In speaking to Evangelical Liberty University in January 2016, Trump cited a verse from 2 Corinthians, earning mockery from those who know the book is 2 Corinthians, and explained his communion practices in terms that some found flippant and theologically incorrect. "When we go in church, and when I drink my little wine, which is about the only wine I drink, and have my little cracker, I guess that's a form of asking for forgiveness," Trump said. Trump also had a checkered history on policy issues usually important to evangelicals and conservative Catholics. He had long taken the liberal positions on gay marriage and abortion, saying in 1999 that he was very pro-choice, and that he cringed when hearing people even debate abortion. Yet exit polls showed that 81% of evangelical Christians supported Trump on Election Day, and a plurality of those Christians consistently supported him during the primary season, even over more proven socially conservative candidates. In the end, that election came at a very consequential moment in the country. We have been heading in the wrong direction for years, and a lot of us felt as though we had to do something to stop it, Bales says, belying a sense of urgency that ultimately got her past her hang-ups about Trump's character. The consequential moment Bales mentioned is made manifest by an increasing tension between a society bent on secular tolerance and restrictions on the exercise of religion. Two of the lasting outcroppings of upheaval during the Obama era were the fallouts from the Supreme Court decision decreeing gay marriage the law of the land, and the insistence, imposed by the party-line passage of the Affordable Care Act, that contraception and abortion services be not only available, but required as coverage in employee or government-provided insurance programs. The raft of similar litigation that later culminated in the Supreme Court's decision in Obergefell v. Hodges, overturning state bans on gay marriage in 2015, spawned a movement at the state level to protect the rights of wedding contractors, such as bakers and florists, who oppose gay marriage, to refuse to participate in those ceremonies. The resulting Religious Freedom Restoration Acts, or RFRAs, were met with fierce resistance by liberal activists, who squeezed corporations to pressure the governors who had signed them in Indiana and Arkansas to back down. One of those governors, social conservative champion Mike Pence, would later become Trump's running mate. The litigation spawned by the Affordable Care Act's reproductive procedure mandates sparked a similar legal war that culminated in Burwell v. Hobby Lobby Stores, in which a slim Supreme Court majority carved out a narrow religious liberty protection for closely held private companies, allowing the owners of those businesses to opt out of contraception and abortion mandates in Obamacare that violate deeply held religious convictions. Those two cases, one in favor of religious liberty and one spawning a ferocious corporate and media campaign against it, brought the threat to the First Amendment's Free Exercise of Religion Clause into full focus for many evangelicals, just in time for the run-up to the 2016 election. Then, on a mid-February Saturday in 2016, the composition of the Supreme Court moved to the top of the voting agenda for evangelicals and other conservatives. On that morning, just 4 days after New Hampshire's first-in-the-nation presidential primary, Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia was found dead on a hunting trip in Texas, removing from the court its most ardent and articulate defender of religious liberty. Though Trump had just decisively won a crowded contest in New Hampshire, the timing, theoretically, should have helped his main rival for the nomination. Texas Senator Ted Cruz had cultivated a huge following among evangelicals and made a big bet to focus on the rash of southern state primaries in early March, where religiously devout voters dominate. Even Bales was in Cruz's camp at that time. "I was a big Ted Cruz fan," she says of the Texas senator, who often talks about his faith when discussing any policy, social or not. Bales and other conservatives helped Cruz win the Badger State's primary decisively on April 15th, Trump's most significant loss in the nomination calendar. But the frontrunner consolidated his support in Indiana 3 weeks later to put Cruz away, leaving evangelicals to choose between only Trump, Clinton, and staying home. And when it dwindled down to, "Wow, these are the two choices, I was just kind of at a loss," Bales says. Even as Trump had surprised observers with his evangelical support in the populist South, the smart money still wagered he could not bring more reluctant evangelicals like Bales aboard. A fatal obstacle for any Republican, since the GOP has historically relied on nearly unanimous support among that group in order to win in November. Bales, not shy about her hesitation regarding Trump, pauses for a very long time. "I don't want to come across as disingenuous, as this person who was all in from the very beginning. I wasn't. It was really hard," she says. "Just knowing about what was coming out about him being a womanizer, and just his mouth and his whole demeanor, just like didn't go with my belief system. That's not the way I talk. That's not the way we act. And I felt like I needed to be accountable to my children for his moral character." Years ago, Bales left rural Wisconsin as a young bride with her husband for Florida, and the change jolted her. "It was scary, and I don't know how I retained the Midwest values down there. It's a whole different, fast-paced culture of me, me, me world. The West Palm Beach area, in our opinion, was not a place to raise children. So we homeschooled down there, and once we came back to Wisconsin, it was like, yeah, this is where we're meant to be," she says. Her husband, Donnie, is from the tiny town of Cameron, West Virginia, just outside of Wheeling, and had a similar worldview. "I wasn't raised knowing about politics whatsoever. I was never taught to vote, that it was an honor or responsibility, none of that. And like I said, getting married at 17, I was really figuring out adulthood by myself anyway, Bales recalls. I got a job for a big telecommunications company, and I immediately, at 18, kind of broke into, I would say, into their union. Bales admits she really didn't know what a union was or why she had to join it. And the union steward said, "Oh, you need to be in it. We have your back." And I just kind of signed on the dotted line, and then they trained me to also become a union steward, she says. It is easy to understand why she was recruited. Bales has a contagious personality. You immediately want to be part of whatever she is doing. Right now, that is volunteering in the community and doing whatever she can to make Seth's life better. But back then, it was getting other people on board with the union. So I was pretty big into the union, and I thought it was a great thing. But what I realized was they were telling me what to do, how to vote. And in fact, they actually drove me down and registered me to vote, she says. I honestly remember the day. I was so naive, and I kind of chuckle about it now. I said to the other union members, "What's the difference between a Republican and a Democrat? I have to check one. What does that mean?" And they told me, "Oh, you're a Democrat because you're working class. Republicans are rich." So I checked Democrat, and that's really all the information I got. I just knew that I wasn't rich, so I was a Democrat. She admits that she was a dispassionate voter at that time in her life. Then I started going to church as a married adult. They talked about the importance of voting your values, and that was the first time I ever heard that. They had a Christian voter guide, and they never told me who to vote for, which I liked, because I was always told who to vote for with the union. But the church didn't tell me who to vote for. But they said, "Look at these morals and values, and if you agree with, you know, being pro-life, if you agree, you know, that the sanctity of human life is important, that the sanctity of marriage is important, these are the questions that were asked to each of the candidates." And that was the first time I thought, wow, I'm really empowered because I know what I stand for, and now I can see what the person that's running for president is standing for, and I get to make that decision. As I looked at what the candidates answered, I thought, wait a second, that's closer to Republican. That's closer to Republican. Actually, I don't identify as a Democrat on any of these issues. She briefly registered as an independent, and then started to really be impressed with her local Republican representatives. Paul Ryan is just my absolute favorite. He has taken the time to talk with me, and I can't believe he's third in command for the president, she says of the Speaker of the House from nearby Janesville, who represents Kenosha County in Congress. For 7 years, she and her husband ran a ministry and the Christian Mission Thrift Store, which was dedicated, Bales says, to spreading the love and message of Jesus Christ through the supporting of gospel-centered church plants, mission trips, missionaries, and supplying resources for those called into full-time ministry. All 7 of her children were hands-on involved. I can't remember anyone complaining about their portion of the work. Along with their devotion to their faith, as parents, they impressed on their children the obligation to exercise their right to vote. Conversations that came back to haunt Bales as she pondered 2 nominees for president she both found lacking. Which is why it was so hard for me to tell them I didn't want to vote in the 2016 election, she says. So I did have a lot of conversations with my children, and I even went through the, "I'm just not going to vote, because I don't want to even, you know, I just can't." And they were shocked, because they were like, "Mom, you can't not vote. You know, that's horrible." Her husband had a solution for reconciling her qualms, however, rooted in Trump's political strength. He saw him as this protector, she says. So I did a lot of research on Christian, different pastors and whatnot, and just came to the realization that we're in a broken world. There's going to be moral conflicts. There's no perfect candidate. And I kept hearing the term, the lesser of two evils, and I hated that. I didn't want to just take the remnants of the lesser of two evils. I really wanted to base my vote on a conviction. So, my conviction kind of came down to pro-life. Which candidate is pro-life? And obviously, Planned Parenthood supported Clinton. And we knew, although people had said Trump wasn't pro-life from the beginning, but his vice president pick had a great history of protecting the unborn and marriage. And that's another thing, she says, interrupting her own train of thought. I love Mike Pence. If it was Mike Pence for president, oh my word, I would be shouting from the rooftops. He's the most pro-life vice president, I think, in our country's history since Roe v. Wade. I mean, he is just an incredible guy. Bales had a history on Facebook in previous elections of vocally reminding her friends of the importance of voting. I was huge on the Mitt Romney-Paul Ryan ticket on Facebook, and just telling my kids as soon as they're able to vote, you've got to exercise that God-given right. And then, in 2016, she went radio silent. People started wondering what was wrong. They wanted to know who I was voting for. What's going on? How come we haven't heard anything from you? You're not posting anything. Are you with anybody or not? Why are you not even stating your point? What's going on? She says of the barrage of questions her friends and family asked her. I'm not going to be a hypocrite, because I was the first one to again say I would not vote for this man. This man doesn't represent me. But even though I changed my mind, I just felt like I needed to keep that to myself, so to speak, if that makes sense. It was the hardest decision I think I've had to make as an adult in any voting process. It was so difficult. And I think that the reason why it was so difficult is because I don't take it lightly. This is important. This is our country. This is my children's, my seven children's future. I don't take that lightly. And I'm accountable to God, to my children, to the unborn. Bales has to leave the interview. She has a daughter to pick up from cheerleading practice and a community outreach program she has to chair. As for Trump, she's still warming to him. Funny, all of that anxiety, all of that praying, and it turns out I like him now much more than I did when I voted for him. Why? He is making the right enemies. Of course, the Supreme Court pick of Justice Neil Gorsuch, but also his sheer willpower in standing up to the traditional powers. It's refreshing. The tweets? Well, not so much. But everything else? Pretty good. Paul and Emily Cherry, Canton, Stark County, Ohio. Pastor Paul Cherry and his wife Emily only have one political disagreement. Paul thought Barack Obama was a talented orator, but Emily had to leave the room any time the former president was on the television. He talked out of both sides of his mouth. It was just so phony and disingenuous to me that I just have to leave the room, she says. I know that's not very Christian of me, but he was dishonest. He just used pretty words, so it fooled so many people. And every time he opened his mouth, he drove me nuts. Her voice trails off. Paul places his arm around her and smiles. There is nothing wrong with what you said. I didn't like him, he continues, but I also didn't hate him, or something like that. But as a speaker, and with his personality, he seemed like somebody I could sit down and have a beer with, talk and be all right with. Paul's smile lingers, sparking her to smile back. Both are still in that full bloom of being newlyweds 1 year after saying, I do. It is the second marriage for both. You know, as a minister, I read off transcripts and stuff. For me, it was just like, this guy knows how to really speak to the people, like speak to the crowd, and get into it. So I respected that talent, he explains. But as far as the foundation that Obama stood on, well, I disagreed with the lot that he stood for. He was not pro-life. He was not a champion of national security. He missed a lot on the economy. A lot of Americans fell behind on his watch. Paul is the pastor of Friendship Community Church in Canton, a Southern Baptist ministry that holds its services at Cedar Elementary School on 9th Street in downtown Canton, a city of 71,323, in the throes of the opioid epidemic that is ravaging Ohio. Two censuses ago, in 2000, Canton had 81,931 people. Emily's voice is deep, but measured. His is subtly charismatic. His sandy blonde hair and neatly trimmed beard create a striking resemblance to the mature Leonardo DiCaprio. He is dedicated to the life he has chosen, to serving God and the community he lives in. He has his work cut out for him. Canton is a city that has not yet coped with its remake from a heavy industrial blue-collar town to a service industry economy. The unemployment isn't astronomically high, but the new jobs created after the bulk of the heavy industry left the city, beginning in the 1980s, are well below what they used to be back when people made things here in Stark County. Like its largest city, Stark is losing population. Economic deficiencies are obvious at every turn here. The poverty rate is over 31%, double the national average. All of the children in the city school system are eligible to receive free breakfast and lunch through the federal community eligibility provision. The district qualified because 40% of its student population are homeless, in foster care, or from a household on welfare or receiving food stamps. A drive along Tuscarawas Street, downtown's main artery, toward a McDonald's, can bring a visitor face to face with an open drug market outside the fast food franchise. Crime follows poverty, so do drugs. People need help, Paul says. Canton's violent crime rate is about 3 times worse than the national average. And opioids? Between 2004 and 2016, there was a 603% increase in adults with opiate use disorder in treatment in Stark County. They used to do a lot of things here. This is a story of used-to-bes, Paul says. The bright spot is just off the interstate, cutting straight through the heart of the city, where the NFL is expanding the Hall of Fame's footprint. In 2016, the league brought on a sponsor, Johnson Controls, a diversified technology company, for naming rights for a $500 million city-within-a-city project that creates a state-of-the-art smart village, an entertainment extension of the Hall of Fame experience. Outside the grid of Canton, Stark County's rolling hills and farmland are a sharp contrast to the decay inside the city. There is even a little unincorporated town called Trump along the old Lincoln Highway. Trump won big here. The evidence that this upset was coming was visible if one was looking closely. Ohioans do not choose a political party when they register to vote, only when they participate in primaries. In 2016, 64% of Stark Countyans who chose to participate in a presidential primary chose a Republican ballot, up from just 42% of county voters who had picked the GOP primary in the 2014 gubernatorial year primary. Ohio Secretary of State John Husted's office told the Canton newspaper that records indicated 5,572 Democrats from past elections switched to the GOP primary in 2016, compared to only 824 Republicans who switched to the Clinton-Sanders primary. 3/5 of the new primary voters with no previous partisan history also chose the Republican primary. Trump ultimately clobbered Clinton 56% to 39% in this county, the same place that Barack Obama won twice, and even John Kerry won in 2004 while losing Ohio and the nation. That kind of political upheaval does not happen because things are going well. and every stat in Starr County bears that out. Paul was born in Norwalk, in north central Ohio. His parents divorced when he was an infant. "My mom remarried, so I never had any recollection of that town," he says. The new family moved to Mansfield. His stepfather worked as a computer programmer, and his mother went back to school to be a nurse. For a long period of his childhood, because of allegations against his dad that Paul does not get into, Paul never saw his father. Eventually, those allegations were proven false, and I moved in with him at the age of 16. I immediately went from a white-collar middle-class family to a working-class situation. My father was blue-collar, worked in the factories, in maintenance, and as an industrial electrician, he says. Paul explains that his mother's home was much more financially stable. "Whereas my dad's was, I never wanted for anything. But I didn't have the same things I did at mom's. But I learned something incredibly valuable that shaped who I am today. And that is, you worked hard for what you had, and you appreciate what you had." He did not immediately attend college after high school. "I worked for a while, and I started out slow, taking night classes at the Ohio State branch in Mansfield. He eventually saved enough to attend Ohio Christian University, south of Columbus, where he got 2 degrees, one in world religions and a bachelor's degree in leadership," he says. "I had a calling to ministry, and that school fit my lifestyle. I still worked full-time, went to school full-time, and flipped houses on the side to pay for school." Paul snags a French fry off Emily's plate. They are having dinner at John's Bar and Grill, a Canton staple for 70 years. It's owned by the Varavas family. 3 generations work there. 2 of those generations are working this evening, and the wood-paneled tavern is packed. Many of the staff have been here for 30-plus years. It is the kind of place where everybody knows your name and your business, whether you like that or not. Paul has been working since he moved in with his dad at 16. We had a local Best Western hotel. I rode my bike down with my best friend, and we used to clean rooms, housekeeping, and work in the laundromat, and sweep the parking lot. I mean, I did whatever they asked us to do, for whatever. It was at the time $5 an hour, I think. I've always had a job. Like through high school, I paid for my car insurance, I paid for my fuel, I paid for my car. I was taught to be responsible, and nothing was free, you know? You work hard, and I've just done that my whole life, he says. He played football and soccer in high school. The discipline also helped shape him. I think it teaches you to put the effort in. If you want to accomplish a task, it's not going to be given. And I mean, not only do you have to train yourself psychologically, mentally, I guess you could say, but you had to do it physically, and you had to do it with others. So, you know, team effort. So I guess that works out in the real world, when you're working in a company together with people. Both Emily and Paul were intuitively drawn to the Republican Party. "I've always been a Republican. I have voted for Democrats, locally," he says. "Same here," says Emily. The attractive brunette with shoulder-length, softly wavy hair takes a call from the babysitter. She has to leave soon to care for their blended family. Paul works 2 full-time jobs right now. "I'm a minister full-time, and I also work full-time as a maintenance manager within a nursing home." He says he met Emily at Alcoholics Anonymous. "Paul," she says, seemingly aghast. "Geez, he tells everyone that. Would you mind telling the real story?" They both fall into deep laughter at his ribbing. "We met online, actually," he says. "I had 2 friends that had successful relationships on Christian Mingle, so they had a free sign-up on Christian Mingle. So they threw me on the Internet, and I met her when I was trying to shut off the membership because it was blowing my phone up." "I was so nervous," Emily says, as her bright green eyes well with tears at the memory. Emily was born in Cleveland, and her parents moved to Canton when she was an infant. Her father was a metallurgist and engineer. Her mother was a stay-at-home mom for years before she went back to nursing school at the University of Akron. My mom always tells people that if you always want to have a job, go into healthcare, become a nurse, or do something in healthcare, she says. Emily's family is very tight-knit. Big family dinners on weekends and holidays. We always joked that anything could become an event, and it was just an excuse to get the entire family together. And, you know, we still do that. We still get together on the holidays, and it's a huge meal, huge production. The spread is always good. If you leave hungry, it's your own fault. Emily attended all 12 years of her schooling at a private school in Canton called Heritage Christian. She then went off to the University of Mount Union for business administration. Both her and her husband's lives have been intertwined with their deep faith. When it came time to vote in 2016, neither went for Donald Trump as their first pick. Paul liked Senator Marco Rubio. Emily liked everyone. Both say they were looking for strength. I didn't think it was going to be Trump. I'll be honest, I just thought that was just a no-show, the pastor says, even though he voted for him in the Ohio primary that wound up being seriously contested only by Trump and Ohio Governor John Kasich. I didn't really have a front-runner. I didn't think Trump was going to be it. At first, I didn't think he was going to be the one. It just got down to the point where I looked at him and started listening to what he had to say. And like Emily always says, I liked what he said about America and what we need in this country, says Paul. The fact that Trump was able to easily convert two people like the Cherries, for whom faith is so central to their voting patterns, is testament to the desperation many conservatives felt after 8 years of Obama and a Republican Congress they believed had not been able to successfully thwart him. The potential for Trump to be a disruptor, a force from outside politics who might be stronger than those in politics, offered the prospect of a successful pushback to many who craved it. I have been deeply rattled about the direction our country has taken, and I was really looking for a defender, a protector of our liberties, if you will, someone who spoke to the issues that have been put on the back burner for years. The Iran deal, calling Fort Hood a workplace violence, how we treated Israel, Syria. Religious liberties always seemed to be under attack, Emily says, peeling off the list of issues that had resonated with her. Trump came more easily to Emily than to Paul. I liked him, she says. He's got that business mind, where he doesn't take crap from anybody, and heck, all we have been taking is crap. There was nobody for me that came out strong except him, and I said, that's my candidate. In Paul's church, he sees the toll that drugs, crime, and hopelessness have taken on otherwise good people, he says. We as a country cannot just let our fellow Americans be left behind, dismissed because someone in Washington or Silicon Valley has decided their time has come and gone. The pastor was also shaken by the country's lack of fortitude in protecting our greatest treasure, he says. That, of course, is our people. It is like we have been disposable to the Democrats. We need leaders who don't consider us a political calculation. Faith and God are central to the Cherries' lives. As their first-year anniversary as a married couple approached, Emily wrote a Facebook post that held nothing back in recounting their early dating years. God-centered, God-blessed, and totally God-orchestrated. 3 years ago today, I was sitting at work on a Tuesday, happy, excited, and completely trying to figure out in what ways Paul was screwed up and not perfect for me. Over the next couple weeks, after continuing to try to find reasons to not be with this amazing man, God continued to push us together and show that He has a plan for our lives together, forever. It's not always been easy these past 3 years, but I would not trade one single day, or go back and do anything different. My best friend, confidant, support system, lover, and husband, among so much more. While Paul's support of Trump came later than Emily's, it has been hardened by what he perceives to be unfair treatment from the media. You know, I don't listen to the media anymore. I don't trust it at all. And it's not because I'm told not to trust it. It's so blatant and obvious now. It's just trash news, you know? You can tell by the first paragraph, you know, whether or not it's worth even reading. Because it starts out, you know, how Trump has screwed up in the first 6 months or first year or whatever. I'm not reading that, you know? Like, I don't expect my president to be perfect. I know he's, like, gonna make mistakes. Nobody's perfect. As both a parent and a pastor, Paul says he deeply worries about what he sees in society and culture when it comes to the demand for free stuff. It seems like what I see from the Democratic Party is, let's play to that group. We'll get you free college. I worked my butt off to pay for college, and they get a free vote. That is not creating a strong country. That is not creating good people. Where is that rugged individualism streak? We need lessons of strength, not promises of what you can get for doing nothing, he says. That is my biggest worry going forward, that lack of strength, of virtue, of standing up for a belief system and values and religious liberties. I worry about young people not having that drive to better themselves. The entitlement thing is so very much there. I see it in my own kids. I find myself as a parent fighting it, even though I'm not teaching it. I am hoping that fighting spirit becomes part of our culture, and some of that entitlement culture starts to lose face. That is what I want going forward, what I wanted to start with Trump. Neil Schaefer, Rural Howard County, Iowa. 150 years ago, 10 Norwegian families descended on this open land to build their lives and expand their families. They were young, courageous, devout, and determined to carve out a decent life filled with family, community, and worship of God. They came by foot, covered wagon, and on horseback. They brought with them oxen, tools, supplies, and all of their meager belongings from the West, a unique directional distinction from the rest of the early settlers. Originally from Wisconsin, this group had initially settled in South Dakota, but found the region unsafe. They went eastward across the new state of Iowa and settled along Crane Creek, where a large tract of land sat as yet unused because of the weak density of the soil. They were soon joined by more immigrants from Norway. Most came here without much more than a trunk or two from home, but they all made sure they brought a series of important books with them, a Bible, a hymn book, and for the children, catechism lessons. God's word and his presence was everything to those early settlers, says Neil Schaefer, a trustee of the Jericho Evangelical Lutheran Church and direct descendant of those early Norwegian settlers who were part of the same congregation that still thrives today. Schaefer's great-grandfather, Ulla J. Anderson, helped build the sturdy white clapboard house of worship in 1913. It is the fourth structure this devout group of farmers and settlers have used, and has been central to their lives for 150 years. His mother, Mavis O. Schaefer, at 90 years of age, is the longest continuous member of the church. On the anniversary marking the congregation's sesquicentennial, the Reverend Craig A. Ferkenstad said as part of his sermon, "We gather here today not to laud the founders of this congregation, but to give thanks for those who passed on the faith to us, and to remember the leaders who spoke the word of God to you. It is by God's grace that we teach and preach the same word of the Bible and the same gospel as was preached 150 years ago, because without God's grace, we would have ruined everything long ago. God's word is everything. It is why this congregation was formed.